Chapter 4. The Liquidation of Anachronisms. 1. Almost before Jane had finished putting clean sheets on Mark's bed, Mrs. Dimble, with a great many parcels, arrived.
"Oh, you're an angel to have me for the night," she said. "We've tried every hotel in Edgestow, I believe. The place is going to become unendurable. The same answer everywhere, all full up with the hangers-on and camp followers of this detestable NICE. Secretaries here, typists there, commissioners of works. The thing's outrageous. If Cecil hadn't had a room at college, I really believe he'd have had to sleep in the waiting room at the station. I only hope that man in college has aired the bed."
"But what on earth's happened?" asked Jane.
"Turned out, my dear."
"But it isn't possible, Mrs. Dimble. I mean, it can't be legal."
"Well, that's what Cecil said. Oh, just think of it, Jane. The first thing we saw when we poked our heads out of the back window this morning was a lorry on the drive with its back wheels in the middle of the rosebed, unloading a small army of what looked like criminals with picks and spades. Right in our own garden. There was an odious little man in a peaked cap who talked to Cecil with a cigarette in his mouth. At least it wasn't in his mouth, but secateened onto his upper lip, you know. And guess what he said? He said they'd have no objection to our remaining in possession of the house, mind you, not the garden, till 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. No objection."
"But surely, oh, surely it must be some mistake."
"Of course. Cecil rang up your bursar.
And, of course, your bursar was out. That took nearly all morning, ringing up again and again, and by that time the big beech that you used to be so fond of had been cut down, and all the plum trees. If I hadn't been so angry, I'd have sat down and cried my eyes out. That's what I felt like. At last Cecil did get on to your Mr. Busby, who was perfectly useless. Said there must be some misunderstanding, but it was out of his hands now, and we'd better get on to the NICE at Belbury. Of course, it turned out to be quite impossible to get them, but by lunchtime we saw that one simply couldn't stay there for the night, whatever happened."
"Why not?" "Oh, my dear, you've no conception what it was like. Great lorries and traction engines roaring past all the time, and a crane on a thing like a railway truck. Why, our own tradesmen couldn't get through it. The milk didn't arrive till 11 o'clock. The meat never arrived at all. They rang up in the afternoon to say their people hadn't been able to reach us by either road. We'd the greatest difficulty in getting into town ourselves. It took us half an hour from our house to the bridge. It was like a nightmare. Flares and noise everywhere, and the road practically ruined, and a sort of great tin camp already going up on the common. And the people, such horrid men. I didn't know we had workpeople like that in England. Oh, horrible, horrible."
Mrs. Dimble fanned herself with the hat she had just taken off.
"And what are you going to do?" asked Jane.
"Heaven knows," said Mrs. Dimble. "For the moment we have shut up the house, and Cecil has been at Rumbold, the solicitor's, to see if we can at least have it sealed and left alone until we've got our things out of it. Rumbold doesn't seem to know where he is. He keeps on saying the NICE are in a very peculiar position legally. After that, I'm sure I don't know. As far as I can see, there won't be any houses in Edgestow. There's no question of trying to live on the far side of the river any longer, even if they'd let us.
What did you say?"
"Oh, indescribable. All the poplars are going down. All those nice little cottages by the church are going down. I found poor Ivy, that's your Mrs. Maggs, you know, in tears. Poor things, they do look dreadful when they cry on top of powder. She's being turned out, too. Poor little woman, she's had enough troubles in her life without this. I was glad to get away. The men were so horrible. Three big brutes came to the back door asking for hot water, and went on so they frightened Martha out of her wits, and Cecil had to go and speak to them. I thought they were going to strike Cecil, really I did. It was most horribly unpleasant. But a sort of special constable sent them away."
"What?
Oh, yes, there are dozens of what look like policemen all over the place, and I didn't like the look of them either, swinging some kind of truncheon things, like what you'd see in an American film. Do you know, Jane, Cecil and I both thought the same thing. We thought, it's almost as if we'd lost the war."
"Oh, good girl, tea. That's just what I wanted."
"You must stay here as long as you like, Mrs. Dimble," said Jane. "Mark'll just have to sleep in college."
"Well, really," said Mother Dimble, "I feel at the moment that no fellow of Bracton ought to be allowed to sleep anywhere. But I'd make an exception in favour of Mr. Studdock. As a matter of fact, I shan't have to behave like the sword of Siegfried, and incidentally a nasty, fat, stodgy sword I should be. But that side of it is all fixed up. Cecil and I are to go out to the manor at St. Anne's. We have to be there so much at present, you see."
"Oh," said Jane, involuntarily prolonging the exclamation as the whole of her own story flowed back on her mind.
"Oh, why, what a selfish pig I've been," said Mother Dimble. Here have I been chattering away about my own troubles and quite forgetting that you've been out there and are full of things to tell me. Did you see Grace, and did you like her?"
"Is Grace Miss Ironwood?" asked Jane.
"Yes. I saw her. I don't know if I liked her or not. But I don't want to talk about all that. I can't think about anything except this outrageous business of yours. It's you who are the real martyr, not me."
"Oh, no, my dear," said Mrs. Dimble. "I'm not a martyr. I'm only an angry old woman with sore feet and a splitting head, but that's beginning to be better, who's trying to talk herself into a good temper. After all, Cecil and I haven't lost our livelihood, as poor Ivy Maggs has. It doesn't really matter, leaving the old house. Do you know, the pleasure of living there was in a way a melancholy pleasure. I wonder, by the by, do humans really like being happy? A little melancholy, yes. All those big upper rooms which we thought we should want because we thought we were going to have lots of children, and then we never had. Perhaps I was getting too fond of mooning about them on long afternoons when Cecil was away. Pitying oneself. I should be better away from it, I dare say. I might have got like that frightful woman in Ibsen who was always maundering about dolls. It's really worse for Cecil. He did so love having all his pupils about the place. Jane, that's the third time you've yawned. You're dropping asleep, and I've talked your head off. It comes of being married 30 years. Husbands were made to be talked to. It helps them to concentrate their minds on what they're reading, like the sound of a weir. There, you're yawning again. Jane found Mother Dimble an embarrassing person to share a room with because she said prayers. It was quite extraordinary, Jane thought, how this put one out. One didn't know where to look, and it was so difficult to talk naturally again for several minutes after Mrs. Dimble had risen from her knees.
2.
"Are you awake now?" said Mrs. Dimble's voice, quietly, in the middle of the night. "Yes," said Jane. "I'm sorry, did I wake you up? Was I shouting?" "Yes. You were shouting out about someone being hit on the head." "I saw them killing a man. A man in a big car driving along a country road. Then he came to a crossroads and turned off to the right past some trees, and there was someone standing in the middle of the road waving a light to stop him. I couldn't hear what they said. I was too far away. They must have persuaded him to get out of the car somehow, and there he was talking to one of them. The light fell full on his face. He wasn't the same old man I saw in my other dream. He hadn't a beard, only a mustache. And he had a very quick, kind of proud way. He didn't like what the man said to him, and presently he put up his fists and knocked him down. Another man behind him tried to hit him on the head with something, but the old man was too quick and turned round in time. Then it was rather horrible, but rather fine. There were 3 of them at him, and he was fighting them all. I've read about that kind of thing in books, but I never realized how one would feel about it. Of course, they got him in the end. They beat his head about terribly with the things in their hands. They were quite cool about it, and stooped down to examine him and make sure he was really dead. The light from the lantern seemed all funny. It looked as if it made long uprights of light, sort of rods, all round the place. But perhaps I was waking up by then. Oh, no, thanks, I'm all right. It was horrid, of course, but I'm not really frightened, not the way I would have been before. I'm more sorry for the old man." "You feel you can go to sleep again?" "Oh, rather. Is your headache better, Mrs. Dimble?" "Quite gone, thank you. Good night."
3. Without a doubt, thought Mark, this must be the mad parson that Bill the Blizzard was talking of. The committee at Belbury did not meet till 10:30, and ever since breakfast he had been walking with the Reverend Strake in the garden, despite the raw and misty weather of the morning. At the very moment when the man had first buttonholed him, the threadbare clothes and clumsy boots, the frayed clerical collar, the dark, lean, tragic face, gashed and ill-shaved and seamed, and the bitter sincerity of his manner, had struck a discordant note. It was not a type Mark had expected to meet in the NICE. "Do not imagine," said Mr. Strake, "that I indulge in any dreams of carrying out our programme without violence. There will be resistance. They will gnaw their tongues and not repent. We are not to be deterred. We face these disorders with a firmness which will lead traducers to say we have desired them. Let them say so. In a sense, we have. It is no part of our witness to preserve that organization of ordered sin which is called society. To that organization, the message which we have to deliver is a message of absolute despair."
"Oh, now, that is what I meant," said Mark, "when I said that your point of view and mine must, in the long run, be incompatible.
The preservation, which involves the thorough planning of society, is just precisely the end I have in view. I do not think there is or can be any other end. The problem is quite different for you, because you look forward to something else, something better than human society, in some other world. With every thought and vibration of my heart, with every drop of my blood, said Mr. Strake, I repudiate that damnable doctrine. That is precisely the subterfuge by which the world, the organization and body of death, has sidetracked and emasculated the teaching of Jesus, and turned into priestcraft and mysticism the plain demand of the Lord for righteousness and judgment here and now. The kingdom of God is to be realized here, in this world. And it will be. At the name of Jesus every knee shall bow. In that name I dissociate myself completely from all the organized religion that has yet been seen in the world. And at the name of Jesus, Mark, who would have lectured on abortion or perversion to an audience of young women without a qualm, felt himself so embarrassed that he knew his cheeks were slightly reddening. And he became so angry with himself and Mr. Strake at this discovery that they then proceeded to redden very much indeed. This was exactly the kind of conversation he could not endure, and never since the well-remembered misery of scripture lessons at school had he felt so uncomfortable. He muttered something about his ignorance of theology. "Theology," said Mr. Strake with profound contempt. "It's not theology I'm talking about, young man, but the Lord Jesus. Theology is talk, eyewash, a smokescreen, a game for rich men. It wasn't in the lecture room I found the Lord Jesus. It was in the coal pits and beside the coffin of my daughter. If they think that theology is a sort of cotton wool which will keep them safe in the great and terrible day, they'll find their mistake. For mark my words, this thing is going to happen. The kingdom is going to arrive in this world, in this country. The powers of science are an instrument, an irresistible instrument, as all of us in the NICE know. And why are they an irresistible instrument? Because science is based on observation, suggested Mark. They are an irresistible instrument, shouted Strake, because they are an instrument in his hand, an instrument of judgment as well as of healing. That is what I couldn't get any of the churches to see. They are blinded, blinded by their filthy rags of humanism, their culture and humanitarianism and liberalism, as well as by their sins, or what they think their sins, though they are really the least sinful thing about them. That is why I have come to stand alone, a poor, weak, unworthy man, but the only prophet left. I knew that he was coming in power, and therefore where we see power, we see the sign of his coming. And that is why I find myself joining with communists and materialists and anyone else who is really ready to expedite the coming. The feeblest of these people here has the tragic sense of life, the ruthlessness, the total commitment, the readiness to sacrifice all merely human values, which I could not find amid all the nauseating cant of the organized religions. You mean, do you, said Mark, that as far as immediate practice is concerned, there are no limits to your cooperation with the program? Sweep away all idea of cooperation, said the other. Does clay cooperate with the potter? Did Cyrus cooperate with the Lord? These people will be used. I shall be used, too. Instruments, vehicles. But here comes the point that concerns you, young man. You have no choice whether you will be used or not. There is no turning back once you have set your hand to the plough. No one goes out of the NICE. Those who try to turn back will perish in the wilderness. But the question is, whether you are content to be one of the instruments which is thrown aside when it has served his turn, one which, having executed judgment on others, is reserved for judgment itself, or will you be among those who enter on the inheritance? For it's all true, you know. It is the saints who are going to inherit the earth, here in England, perhaps within the next 12 months. The saints and no one else. Know you not that we shall judge angels? Then suddenly lowering his voice, Strake added, The real resurrection is even now taking place, the real life everlasting. Here, in this world, you will see it. I say, said Mark, it's nearly 20 past. Oughtn't we to be going to the committee? Strake turned with him in silence. Partly to avoid further conversation along the same lines, and partly because he really wanted to know the answer, Mark said presently, A rather annoying thing has happened. I've lost my wallet. There wasn't much money in it, only about 3 pounds. But there were letters and things, and it's a nuisance. Ought I to tell someone about it?
You could tell the steward, said Strake.
4. The committee sat for about 2 hours, and the deputy director was in the chair. His method of conducting business was slow and involved, and to Mark, with his Bracton experience to guide him, it soon became obvious that the real work of the NICE must go on somewhere else. This, indeed, was what he had expected, and he was too reasonable to suppose that he should find himself, at this early stage, in the inner ring, or whatever at Belbury corresponded to the progressive element at Bracton. But he hoped he would not be kept marking time on phantom committees for too long. This morning, the business mainly concerned the details of the work which had already begun at Edgestow. The NICE had apparently won some sort of victory which gave it the right to pull down the little Norman church at the corner. The usual objections were, of course, tabled, said Wither. Mark, who was not interested in architecture, and who did not know the other side of the wind nearly so well as his wife, allowed his attention to wander. It was only at the end of the meeting that Wither opened a much more sensational subject. He believed that most of those present had already heard. Why do chairmen always begin that way, thought Mark, the very distressing piece of news which it was nevertheless his duty now to communicate to them in a semi-official manner. He was referring, of course, to the murder of William Hengist. As far as Mark could discover from the chairman's tortuous and elusive narrative, Bill the Blizzard had been discovered with his head beaten in by some blunt instrument lying near his car in Potter's Lane at about 4 o'clock that morning. He had been dead for several hours. Mr. Wither ventured to suppose that it would be a melancholy pleasure to the committee to know that the NICE police had been on the scene of the crime before five, and that neither the local authorities nor Scotland Yard were making any objections to the fullest collaboration. He felt that if the occasion were more appropriate, he would have welcomed a motion for some expression of the gratitude they must all feel to Miss Hardcastle, and possibly of congratulations to her on the smooth interaction between her own forces and those of the state. This was a most gratifying feature in the sad story, and, he suggested, a good omen for the future. Some decently subdued applause went round the table at this. Mr. Wither then proceeded to speak at some length about the dead man. They had all much regretted Mr. Hengist's resolution to withdraw from the NICE, while fully appreciating his motives. They had all felt that this official severance would not in the least alter the cordial relations which existed between the deceased and almost all, he thought he could even say all, without exception, of his former colleagues in the Institute. The obituary, in Raleigh's fine phrase, was an instrument which the deputy director's talents well fitted him to play, and he spoke at great length. He concluded by suggesting that they should all stand in silence for 1 minute as a token of respect for the memory of William Hengist. And they did. A world-without-end minute in which odd creakings and breathings became audible, and behind the mask of each glazed and tight-lipped face, shy, irrelevant thoughts of this and that came creeping out, as birds and mice creep out again in the clearing of a wood when the picnickers have gone. And everyone silently assured himself that he, at least, was not being morbid and not thinking about death. Then there was a stir and a bustle, and the committee broke up. 5. The whole process of getting up and doing the morning jobs was more cheerful, Jane found, because she had Mrs. Dimble with her. Mark often helped, but as he always took the view, and Jane could feel it, even if he did not express it in words, that anything would do, and that Jane made a lot of unnecessary work, and that men could keep house with a tithe of the fuss and trouble which women made about it. Mark's help was one of the commonest causes of quarrels between them. Mrs. Dimble, on the other hand, fell in with her ways. It was a bright, sunny morning, and as they sat down to breakfast in the kitchen, Jane was feeling bright herself. During the night, her mind had evolved a comfortable theory that the mere fact of having seen Miss Ironwood and had it all out would probably stop the dreams altogether. The episode would be closed. And now there was all the exciting possibility of Mark's new job to look forward to. She began to see pictures in her mind. Mrs. Dimble was anxious to know what had happened to Jane at St. Anne's, and when she was going there again. Jane answered evasively on the first question, and Mrs. Dimble was too polite to press it. As to the second, Jane thought she wouldn't bother Miss Ironwood again, or wouldn't bother any further about the dreams. She said she had been silly, but felt sure she'd be all right now. And she glanced up at the clock and wondered why Mrs. Maggs hadn't yet turned up.
"Oh, my dear, I'm afraid you've lost Ivy Maggs," said Mrs. Dimble. "Didn't I tell you they'd taken her house too? I thought you'd understand she wouldn't be coming to you in future. You see, there's nowhere for her to live in Edgestow."
"Bother," said Jane, and added, without much interest in the reply, "What is she doing, do you know?"
"She's gone out to St. Anne's."
"Well, has she got friends there?"
"She's gone to the manor, along with Cecil and me."
"Do you mean she's got a job there?"
"Well, yes, I suppose it is a job."
Mrs. Dimble left at about 11. She also, it appeared, was going to St. Anne's, but was first to meet her husband and lunch with him at Northumberland. Jane walked down to the town with her to do a little shopping, and they parted at the bottom of Market Street. It was just after this that Jane met Mr. Curry.
"Have you heard the news, Mrs. Studdock?" said Curry.
His manner was always important, and his tone always vaguely confidential, but this morning they seemed more so than usual.
"No. What's wrong?" said Jane.
She thought Mr. Curry a pompous fool, and Mark a fool for being impressed by him. But as soon as Curry began speaking, her face showed all the wonder and consternation he could have wished. Nor were they, this time, feigned. He told her that Mr. Hingist had been murdered sometime during the night, or in the small hours of that morning. The body had been found lying beside his car in Potter's Lane, badly beaten about the head. He had been driving from Belbury to Edgestow. Curry was at the moment hastening back to the college to talk to the warden about it. He had just been at the police station. One saw that the murder had already become Curry's property. The matter was, in some indefinable sense, in his hands, and he was heavy with responsibility. At another time Jane would have found this amusing. She escaped from him as soon as possible and went into Blackie's for a cup of coffee. She felt she must sit down. The death of Hingist in itself meant nothing to her. She had met him only once, and she had accepted from Mark the view that he was a disagreeable old man and rather a snob. But the certainty that she herself in her dream had witnessed a real murder shattered at one blow all the consoling pretences with which she had begun the morning. It came over her with sickening clarity that the affair of her dreams, far from being ended, was only beginning. The bright, narrow little life which she had proposed to live was being irremediably broken into. Windows into huge, dark landscapes were opening up on every side, and she was powerless to shut them. It would drive her mad, she thought, to face it alone. The other alternative was to go back to Miss Ironwood, but that seemed to be only a way of going deeper into all this darkness. This manor at St. Anne's, this kind of company, was mixed up in it. She didn't want to get drawn in. It was unfair. It wasn't as if she had asked much of life. All she wanted was to be left alone. And the thing was so preposterous. The sort of thing which, according to all the authorities she had hitherto accepted, could not really happen. 6. Cosser, the freckle-faced man with a little wisp of black moustache, approached Mark as he was coming away from the committee.
"You and I have a job to do," he said. "Got to get out a report about Cure Hardy."
Mark was very relieved to hear of a job, but he was a little on his dignity, not having liked Cosser much when he had met him yesterday, and he answered, "Does that mean I am to be in Steele's department after all?"
"That's right," said Cosser.
"The reason I ask," said Mark, "is that neither he nor you seemed particularly keen on having me. I don't want to push myself in, you know. I don't need to stay at the NICE at all, if it comes to that."
"Well, don't start talking about it here," said Cosser. "Come upstairs."
They were talking in the hall, and Mark noticed Wither pacing thoughtfully towards them. "Wouldn't it be as well to speak to him and get the whole thing thrashed out?" he suggested. But the deputy director, after coming within 10 feet of them, had turned in another direction. He was humming to himself under his breath, and seemed so deep in thought that Mark felt the moment unsuitable for an interview. Cosser, though he said nothing, apparently thought the same, and so Mark followed him up to an office on the third floor.
"It's about the village of Cure Hardy," said Cosser, when they were seated. "You see, all that land at Bragdon Wood is going to be little better than a swamp once they get to work. Why the hell we wanted to go there, I don't know. Anyway, the latest plan is to divert the wind. Block up the old channel through Edgestow altogether. Look, here's Shillingbridge, 10 miles north of the town. It's to be diverted there and brought down an artificial channel, here to the east where the blue line is, and rejoin the old bed down here."
"Well, the university will hardly agree to that," said Mark. "What would Edgestow be without the river?"
"Oh, we've got the university by the short hairs," said Cosser. "You needn't worry about that. Anyway, it's not our job. The point is that the new wine must come right through Cure Hardy. Now, look at your contours. Cure Hardy is in the narrow little valley. Eh? Oh, you've been there, have you? Well, that makes it all the easier.
I don't know these parts myself. Well, the idea is to dam the valley at the southern end and make a big reservoir. You'll need a new water supply for Edgestone now that it's to be the second city in the country. But what happens to Cure Hardy? Well, that's another advantage. We build a new model village. It's to be called Jules Hardy or Wither Hardy, 4 miles away, over here, on the railway. I say, you know, there'll be the devil of a stink about this. Cure Hardy is famous. It's a beauty spot. There are the 16th-century almshouses and a Norman church and all that. Well, exactly. That's where you and I come in. We've got to make a report on Cure Hardy. We'll run out and have a look round tomorrow, but we can write most of the report today. It ought to be pretty easy. If it's a beauty spot, you can bet it's insanitary. That's the first point to stress. Then we've got to get out some facts about the population. I think you'll find it consists almost entirely of the two most undesirable elements, small rentier and agricultural labourers. The small rentier is a bad element, I agree, said Mark. I suppose the agricultural labourer is more controversial. The Institute doesn't approve of him. He's a very recalcitrant element in a planned community, and he's always backward. We're not going in for English agriculture. So you see, all we have to do is verify a few facts. Otherwise, the report writes itself. Mark was silent for a moment or two. Well, that's easy enough, he said. But before I get down to it, I'd just like to be a bit clearer about my own position. Oughtn't I go and see Steele? I don't fancy settling down to work in this department if he doesn't want to have me.
I wouldn't do that, said Cosser.
Why not?
Well, for one thing, Steele can't prevent you if the DD backs you up, as he seems to be doing for the moment. For another, Steele is rather a dangerous man. If you just go quietly on with the job, he may get used to you in the end. But if you go and see him, it might lead to a bust-up. There's another thing, too.
Cosser paused, picked his nose thoughtfully, and proceeded, "Between ourselves, I don't think things can go on indefinitely in this department in the way they are at present." The excellent training which Mark had had at Bracton enabled him to understand this. Cosser was hoping to get Steele out of the department altogether. He thought he saw the whole situation. Steele was dangerous while he lasted, but he might not last.
"I got the impression yesterday," said Mark, "that you and Steele hit it off together rather well."
"The great thing here," said Cosser, "is never to quarrel with anyone. I hate quarrels myself. I can get on with anybody, as long as the work gets done."
"Of course," said Mark.
"By the way, if we go to Cure Hardy tomorrow, I might as well run into Edgestone and spend the night at home."
For Mark, a good deal hung on the answer to this. He might find out whether he were actually under orders from Cosser. If Cosser said, "You can't do that," he would at least know where he stood. If Cosser said that Mark couldn't be spared, that would be better still. Or Cosser might reply that he'd better consult the DD. That also would have made Mark feel surer of his position. But Cosser merely said, "Oh," leaving Mark in doubt whether no one needed leave of absence or whether Mark was not sufficiently established as a member of the Institute for his absence to be of any consequence. Then they went to work on their report. It took them the rest of the day, so that Cosser and he came in to dinner late and without dressing. This gave Mark a most agreeable sensation, and he enjoyed the meal, too. Although he was among men he had not met before, he seemed to know everyone within the first 5 minutes and to be joining naturally in the conversation. He was learning how to talk their shop. "How nice it is," said Mark to himself next morning as the car left the main road at Duke's Eton and began descending the bumpy little lane into the long valley where Cure Hardy lay. Mark was not, as a rule, very sensitive to beauty, but Jane and his love for Jane had already awakened him a little in this respect. Perhaps the winter morning sunlight affected him all the more because he had never been taught to regard it as specially beautiful, and it therefore worked on his senses without interference. The earth and the sky had the look of things recently washed. The brown fields looked as if they would be good to eat, and those in grass set off the curves of the little hills as close-clipped hair sets off the body of a horse. The sky looked further away than usual, but also clearer, so that the long, slender streaks of cloud, dark slate colour against the pale blue, had edges as clear as if they were cut out of cardboard. Every little copse was black and bristling as a hairbrush, and when the car stopped in Cure Hardy itself, the silence that followed the turning off of the engine was filled with the noise of rooks that seemed to be calling, "Wake! Wake!"
"Bloody awful noise those birds make," said Cosser.
Got your map? Now. He plunged at once into business. They walked about that village for 2 hours and saw with their own eyes all the abuses and anachronisms they came to destroy. They saw the recalcitrant and backward labourer and heard his views on the weather. They met the wastefully supported pauper in the person of an old man shuffling across the courtyard of the almshouses to fill a kettle, and the elderly rentier, to make matters worse, she had a fat old dog with her, in earnest conversation with the postman. It made Mark feel as if he were on a holiday, for it was only on holidays that he had ever wandered about an English village. For that reason he felt pleasure in it. It did not quite escape him that the face of the backward labourer was rather more interesting than Cossa's, and his voice a great deal more pleasing to the ear. The resemblance between the elderly rentier and Aunt Gilly, when had he last thought of her? Good Lord, that took one back, did make him understand how it was possible to like that kind of person. All this did not in the least influence his sociological convictions. Even if he had been free from Bellbury and wholly unambitious, it could not have done so, for his education had had the curious effect of making things that he read and wrote more real to him than things he saw. Statistics about agricultural labourers were the substance. Any real ditcher, ploughman, or farmer's boy was the shadow. Though he had never noticed it himself, he had a great reluctance in his work ever to use such words as man or woman. He preferred to write about vocational groups, elements, classes, and populations. For, in his own way, he believed as firmly as any mystic in the superior reality of the things that are not seen. And yet, he could not help rather liking this village. When, at 1 o'clock, he persuaded Cossa to turn into the Two Bells, he even said so. They had both brought sandwiches with them, but Mark felt he would like a pint of beer. In the Two Bells it was very warm and dark, for the window was small. Two labourers, no doubt recalcitrant and backward, were sitting with earthenware mugs at their elbows, munching very thick sandwiches, and a third was standing up at the counter, conducting a conversation with the landlord. "No beer for me, thanks," said Cossa, "and we don't want to muck about here too long. What were you saying?" I was saying that on a fine morning there is something rather attractive about a place like this, in spite of all its obvious absurdities. Yes, it is a fine morning. Makes a real difference to one's health, a bit of sunlight. I was thinking of the place.
You mean this?
Said Cossa, glancing round the room. I should have thought it was just the sort of thing we wanted to get rid of. No sunlight, no ventilation. Haven't much use for alcohol myself. Read the Miller report. But if people have got to have their stimulants, I'd like to see them administered in a more hygienic way. I don't know that the stimulant is quite the whole point, said Mark, looking at his beer. The whole scene was reminding him of drinks and talks long ago, of laughter and arguments in undergraduate days. Somehow one had made friends more easily then. He wondered what had become of all that set, of Carey and Wadsden and Denniston, who had so nearly got his own fellowship. "Don't know, I'm sure," said Cossa, in answer to his last remark. "Nutrition isn't my subject. You'd want to ask Stock about that." "What I'm really thinking about," said Mark, "is not this pub, but the whole village. Of course you're quite right, that sort of thing has to go, but it had its pleasant side. We'll have to be careful that whatever we're building up in its place will really be able to beat it on all levels, not merely in efficiency." "Oh, architecture and all that," said Cossa. "Well, that's hardly my line, you know. That's more for someone like Wither. Have you nearly finished?" All at once it came over Mark what a terrible bore this little man was, and in the same moment he felt utterly sick of the NICE. But he reminded himself that one could not expect to be in the interesting set at once. There would be better things later on. Anyway, he had not burnt his boats. Perhaps he would chuck up the whole thing and go back to Bracton in a day or two. But not at once. It would be only sensible to hang on for a bit and see how things shaped. On their way back, Cossa dropped him near Edgestow Station, and as he walked home, Mark began to think of what he would say to Jane about Bellbury. You will quite misunderstand him if you think he was consciously inventing a lie. Almost involuntarily, as the picture of himself entering the flat and of Jane's questioning face arose in his mind, there arose also the imagination of his own voice answering her, hitting off the salient features of Bellbury in amusing, confident phrases. This imaginary speech of his own gradually drove out of his mind the real experiences he had undergone.
Those real experiences of misgivings and of uneasiness indeed quickened his desire to cut a good figure in the eyes of his wife. Almost without noticing it, he had decided not to mention the affair of Cure Hardy. Jane cared for old buildings and all that sort of thing. As a result, when Jane, who was at that moment drawing the curtains, heard the door opening and looked round and saw Mark, she saw a rather breezy and buoyant Mark. Yes, he was almost sure he'd got the job. The salary wasn't absolutely fixed, but he'd be going into that tomorrow. It was a very funny place. He'd explain all that later. But he had already got onto the real people there. Wither and Miss Hardcastle were the ones that mattered. "I must tell you about the Hardcastle woman," he said. "She's quite incredible." Jane had to decide what she would say to Mark much more quickly than he had decided what he would say to her. And she decided to tell him nothing about the dreams or St. Anne's. Men hated women who had things wrong with them, especially queer, unusual things. Her resolution was easily kept, for Mark, full of his own story, asked her no questions. She was not, perhaps, entirely convinced by what he said. There was a vagueness about all the details. Very early in the conversation, she said in a sharp, frightened voice. She had no idea how he disliked that voice. "Mark, you haven't given up your fellowship at Bracton." He said no, of course not, and went on. She listened only with half her mind. She knew he often had rather grandiose ideas, and from something in his face she divined that during his absence he had been drinking much more than he usually did. And so, all evening, the male bird displayed his plumage, and the female played her part, and asked questions, and laughed, and feigned more interest than she felt. Both were young, and if neither loved very much, each was still anxious to be admired. 7. That evening, the fellows of Bracton sat in common room over their wine and dessert. They had given up dressing for dinner as an economy during the war, and not yet resumed the practice, so that their sports coats and cardigans struck a somewhat discordant note against the dark Jacobean panels, the candlelight, and the silver of many different periods. Featherstone and Curry were sitting together. Until that night, for about 300 years, this common room had been one of the pleasant, quiet places of England. It was in Lady Alice, on the ground floor beneath the solar, and the windows at its eastern end looked out on the river and on Bragdon Wood, across a little terrace where the fellows were in the habit of taking their dessert on summer evenings. At this hour and season these windows were, of course, shut and curtained, and from beyond them came such noises as had never been heard in that room before, shouts and curses and the sound of lorries heavily drumming past, or harshly changing gear, rattling of chains, drumming of mechanical drills, clanging of iron, whistles, thuddings, and an all-pervasive vibration. Saiva sonare verbera tum stridor ferri tractaeque catenae, as Glossop, sitting on the far side of the fire, had observed to Jewel. For beyond those windows, scarcely 30 yards away on the other side of the wind, the conversion of an ancient woodland into an inferno of mud and noise and steel and concrete was already going on apace. Several members even of the progressive element, those who had rooms on this side of the college, had already been grumbling about it. Curry himself had been a little surprised by the form which his dream had taken now that it was a reality, but he was doing his best to brazen it out, and though his conversation with Featherstone had to be conducted at the top of their voices, he made no allusion to this inconvenience. "It's quite definite, then," he bawled, "that young Studdock is not coming back." "No, quite," shouted Featherstone. "He sent me a message through a high official to tell me to let the college know." "When will he send a formal resignation?" "I haven't an earthly. Like all these youngsters, he's very casual about these things. As a matter of fact, the longer he delays, the better." "You mean it gives us a chance to look about us?" "Quite. You see, nothing need come before the college till he writes. One wants to have the whole question of his successor taped before that." "Oh, obviously. That is most important. Once you present an open question to all these people who don't understand the field and don't know their own minds, you get anything happening." "Exactly. That's what we want to avoid. The only way to manage a place like this is to produce your candidate, bring the rabbit out of a hat, 2 minutes after you've announced the vacancy. We must begin thinking about it at once." "Does his successor have to be a sociologist? I mean, is the fellowship tied to the subject?" "Oh, not in the least. It's one of those Paston fellowships. Why, had you any subject in mind?" "Well, it's a long time since we had anyone in politics." "Oh, yes.
There's still a considerable prejudice against politics as an academic subject. I say, Featherstone, oughtn't we to give this new subject a leg up?
What new subject?
Pragmatometry.
Well, now, it's funny you should say that, because the man I was beginning to think of is a politician who has also been going in a good deal for pragmatometry. One could call it a fellowship in social pragmatometry, or something like that.
Well, who is the man?
Laird, from Leicester, Cambridge.
It was automatic for Curry to look very thoughtful, though he had never heard of Laird, and to say,
Ah, Laird, just remind me of the details of his academic career.
Well, said Featherstone, as you remember, he was in bad health at the time of his finals and came rather a cropper. The Cambridge examining is so bad nowadays that one hardly counts that. Everyone knew he was one of the most brilliant men of his year. He was president of the Sphinxes and used to edit The Adult. David Laird, you know.
Yes, yeah, to be sure, David Laird. But I say, Dick.
Yes?
I'm not quite happy about his bad degree. Of course, I don't attach a superstitious value to examination results any more than you do. Still, we have made one or two unfortunate elections lately.
Almost involuntarily, as he said this, Curry glanced across the room to where Pelham sat. Pelham, with his little button-like mouth and his pudding face. Pelham was a sound man, but even Curry found it difficult to remember anything that Pelham had ever done or said.
"Yes, I know," said Featherstone. "But even our worst elections aren't quite so dim as those the college makes when we leave it to itself."
Perhaps because the intolerable noise had frayed his nerves, Curry felt a momentary doubt about the dimness of these outsiders. He had dined recently at Northumberland and found Telford dining there the same night. The contrast between the alert and witty Telford, whom everyone at Northumberland seemed to know, whom everyone listened to, and the dim Telford in Bracton Common Room had perplexed him. Could it be that the silences of all these outsiders in his own college, their monosyllabic replies when he condescended, and their blank faces when he assumed his confidential manner, had an explanation which had never occurred to him? The fantastic suggestion that he, Curry, might be a bore passed through his mind so swiftly that a second later he had forgotten it forever. The much less painful suggestion that these traditionalists and research beetles affected to look down on him was retained. But Featherstone was shouting at him again.
"I'm going to be at Cambridge next week," he said. "In fact, I'm giving a dinner. I'd as soon it wasn't mentioned here, because, as a matter of fact, the PM may be coming, and one or two big newspaper people, and Tony Dew.
What?"
"Of course you know Tony, that little dark man from the bank. Laird is going to be there. He's some kind of cousin of the PM's. I was wondering if you could join us. I know David's very anxious to meet you. He's heard a lot about you from some chap who used to go to your lectures. I can't remember the name.
Well, it would be very difficult. It rather depends on when old Bill's funeral is to be. I should have to be here for that, of course.
Was there anything about the inquest on the 6 o'clock news?"
"I didn't hear. But, of course, that raises a second question. Now that Blizzard has gone to blow in a better world, we have two vacancies."
"I can't hear," yelled Curry. "Is this noise getting worse, or am I getting deaf?"
"I say, Sub-Warden," shouted Briseacre from beyond Featherstone, "what the devil are your friends outside doing?"
"Can't they work without shouting?" asked someone else.
"Doesn't sound like work at all to me," said a third.
"Listen," said Glossop suddenly. "That's not work. Listen to the feet. It's more like a game of rugger."
"It's getting worse every minute," said Rayner.
Next moment, nearly everyone in the room was on his feet.
"What was that?" shouted one.
"They're murdering someone," said Glossop. "There's only one way of getting a noise like that out of a man's throat."
"Where are you going?" asked Curry.
"I'm going to see what's happening," said Glossop.
"Curry, go and collect all the shooters in college. Someone ring up the police."
"I shouldn't go out if I were you," said Featherstone, who had remained seated and was pouring himself out another glass of wine. "It sounds as if the police or something was there already."
"What do you mean?"
"Listen. There."
"I thought that was their infernal drill."
"Listen."
"My God. Do you really think it's a machine gun?"
"Look out! Look out!"
said a dozen voices at once, as a splintering of glass became audible and a shower of stones fell onto the common room floor. A moment later, several of the fellows had made a rush for the windows and put up the shutters. And then they were all standing staring at one another, and silent but for the noise of their heavy breathing. Glossop had a cut on the forehead. and on the floor lay the fragments of that famous east window on which Henrietta Maria had once cut her name with a diamond.